Okay. Okay, let me say, I'm going to be trying to sort of give you an overview of some of the things I've been thinking about over the last 2 years in collaboration with Leon, who's here, and any difficult questions you can send in his direction, Chetan Nayak, and more recently, Cento. And in particular, we've been trying to think about strongly correlated two-dimensional electron systems in sort of a dual representation where we're focusing on the vortices in the underlying system rather than the particles themselves. So I want to first give you a bit of motivation for why one might want to do that. And then in the latter part of the talk, I want to describe a reformulation of the first part of the talk in terms of a perhaps a more familiar representation using the particles rather than the vortices. And there's a Z2 gauge theory, which Cento has been heavily involved with. So some of the questions I want to focus on are, in the context of the Coupe rates, high-temperature superconductors, does the electron decay? I'll sort of tell you what I mean by that. I want to try to tell you why it's helpful or useful, I think, to think about vortices in the context of strongly interacting electrons. And also I want to tell you why Z2 gauge symmetry seems to be playing a rather important role. Okay, so let me just answer those three questions, and then you can all go to sleep. Does the electron decay in the Coupe rates? I hope so. That's my real answer on that one, but I honestly I'm not sure.
What do you mean by this?
Well, I'll tell you. Yeah, you have to stay awake if you want to know what the questions mean. I mean, but if you just want to know the answers, there it is. Why vortices? Well, as I'll try to emphasize, it gives one a way to understand exotic Mott insulating phases in two dimensions in which the electron is splintered into pieces, that is, it's fractionalized. In particular, gives one a way to understand the nodal liquid phase, which is an example of such a Mott insulator. Why the Z2 gauge symmetry? Rather surprising fact is that it's actually broken in a BCS superconductor, but I think more importantly, it gives us, I think, a rather new formulation of thinking about correlated electrons. Now, I've been thinking about vortices for 10 years, or maybe longer, and promulgating vortices in the last few years, to quote one of my collaborators. This has largely fallen on deaf ears, which is understandable. But about 4 or 5 months ago, I took a wonderful vacation in Sedona, Arizona, which is a lovely resort town north of Phoenix. And I found in the hotel that we were staying in some literature which told me that at least there was some audience out there for vortices. So this was a vortex map. And the nice thing was, in this particular bit of literature, it told us what a vortex was. So let me tell you what they say. Well, I particularly like this definition. A vortex has been described as a whirling mass of energy in places where the natural electromagnetic field of the Earth is particularly strong. Okay, that sounds pretty crazy. You might particularly want to know how crystals fit into the picture. That will be a second talk. I won't. If you're confused by this, they're very reassuring at the end, saying, this is a very brief version. There are many good books on the subject. Well, frankly, I haven't found any good books. But when I started telling these people about quantum vortices, they got pretty excited. They hadn't heard of those things yet, so. Okay. Two-dimensional correlated systems have a lot of strange properties, in particular when one is near a Mott insulating state or a Wigner crystal, and moreover when those insulating or crystalline states are in close proximity to metals or superconductors. So in particular, I want to pretty much focus on the Coupe rates, and you've seen the phase diagram hundreds of times, where in addition to the D-ray superconductor and the antiferromagnet, one has this strange sort of pseudo-gap region where it looks like there's some sort of spin gap possibly opening up. Up here in the optimally doped region, up to rather high temperatures, one seems to have what is sometimes called a strange metal with rather atypical of a Fermi liquid description that one might have thought should apply. The phase diagram, in fact, in the silicon MOSFETs is perhaps not altogether unrelated. Two-dimensional electron gas at very low carrier densities, where the Coulomb interactions are dominant, shows strongly insulating behavior, which people have suggested, and I think is reasonable, might be associated with Wigner crystallization, some sort of solidification of the electrons, rather analogous, I think, to the Mott insulator. At high densities, one recovers sand and metallic behavior with the resistance independent of temperature, low temperatures. But there's a very strange physics going on in this intermediate density regime, which between extremely low densities and not so low densities, where there seems to be some evidence for spin gap behavior, some sort of strange metal. I think one could add to this, in fact, Aaron Kapitulnik's experiments on superconducting thin films. So in the context of the coupe rate, the questions that I've really been trying to focus on are really, what are the nature of the underlying quantum phases? That is, what are the nature of the zero temperature fixed points which describe the phases in these systems? So in particular, one might ask, the D-wave superconductor, is that a conventional BCS superconductor with nodal quasiparticles? And can we describe that well with BCS theory? How about the antiferromagnet? Is that a garden variety antiferromagnetic insulator that one perhaps could describe in terms of a nesting instability of a Fermi surface? What about intervening phases, if we perhaps want to think about, between that sometimes occur between the antiferromagnet and the D-wave superconductor? Do we have, what sort of ordering do we have going on there? Charge order and particularly spin order in terms of stripes has been suggested, and there's certainly some evidence experimentally for that. We've heard about that here as well.
In your opinion,
no, they're the same. Yeah, those a garden antiferromagnet is qualitatively the same. Well, because I can construct for you a non-garden variety one, which is you can't describe in this way. Yeah, no, these two are the same, but they're in such a. Okay, let me put it this way. Okay, what I want to focus on in these quantum phases is there a pole in the electron spectral function at any wave vector in the Brillouin zone as a function of energy? I mean, I'm talking about a pole in frequency on the real energy axis. That is a place where the electron doesn't decay. So if you just add an electron at that wave vector and that energy, it would live there forever. Okay. Said more loosely, the question of, is there an electron in the spectrum? And the nice thing about this question is it's really a yes-no question. I mean, it's either the electron does decay or it doesn't. And in the garden variety antiferromagnet, described any way you like, basically, that you're familiar with, there should be a pole in the electron spectral function above a gap somewhere in the Brillouin zone. In fact, all the familiar phases, Fermi liquids, the conventional BCS D-wave superconductor, an antiferromagnet spin piles phase, charge density waves, spin density waves, striped spin density waves, they all are expected to have a pole in the electron spectral function. That is, the electron is expected to be in the spectrum and in such a form that it doesn't decay into some sort of constituent particles. We've been playing around with exotic phases, which I'd like to describe a little bit to you. One which is an exotic superconductor, another, the nodal liquid, is an exotic Mott insulator, and in these phases, the electron, in fact, does decay, and it decays into spin and charge constituents.
Matthew, just to understand your language, what you really mean pole, you really pole.
Yeah, at zero temperature, no disorder, crystal momentum is a good quantum number.
Just to understand your language, so you would say that the answer to your question in quantum Hall system would be no, there's no electron in the spectrum, or there is?
I think the electron would decay into three Laughlin quasiparticles, yeah, at least. Yeah, no, but that's right, but it's not going to be a pole. Yeah, no, definitely.
So the answer is no.
So a sharp peak in A, okay, omega,
yeah.
Would say that the victim is guaranteed that
it's decay. Is it like, yeah, okay, so you want it now, of course, so you want, would,
equals zero.
Yeah, it should be infinitely sharp, you know, in an ideal world, and
that's what you mean by not decay. decaying.
Yeah, that's what I mean by not decaying. So
any amount of lifetime says that it's decaying.
Yeah. At zero temperature and, you know, with translation invariance, you're not getting momentum spearing and so forth. So this is some data. In fact, I was just returning from a meeting in Toronto on high temperature superconductivity, and ZX Shen, a photo emission specialist up at Stanford, gave me some of his most recent data on BISCO 2212. And what's shown here is the essentially what's proportional to the electron spectral function versus energy. So this is, if you will, A of k and omega versus omega at fixed momentum at a point pi zero in the Brillouin zone. And you see five different curves, or six different curves, I guess, which are four different superconducting transition temperatures. So this is, in fact, I believe an optimally doped BISCO material with TC of 90 degrees. And as you underdope, the spectral function evolves as shown here. The main thing I want to focus on or emphasize here, which I think is rather striking, and this is really quite a ubiquitous feature in these materials, is that there's a dramatic difference between the superconducting electron spectral function and the electron spectral function in the normal state above TC. So what one's really comparing to is the dotted line and the solid lines, or the dashed line and the solid lines, which are the spectral functions 15 degrees typically above TC or 10 degrees below TC. It doesn't really matter so much how much you go above TC or how much you go below. And the dramatic feature is that these electron spectral functions are smeared in the normal state above TC, but once you pop below TC, there's this rather sharp peak, which sort of comes out of the noise. And as you underdope, the width of this peak doesn't change particularly. It just loses amplitude, so the weight under the peak goes down. Okay, so this is something one...
Yeah.
Well, you can look at other wave vectors, and there are so the qualitative behavior is the same. It's not quite as dramatic, the peak at other wave vectors, in particular at along the diagonal. It's not so dramatic as one has here. This is certainly the most dramatic case. What's true, though, essentially always, is that above TC at any wave vector, the electron function is smeared. And now one is finding that below TC, in fact, all the way along the Fermi surface, one is getting a sharper feature in the spectral function, but the sharpest feature is at pi zero. And, well, that's a puzzle, precisely why it should be like that. But I should say, in a Fermi liquid, one would expect, a sharp feature in the spectral function. And one sees that in photo emission off more traditional materials. There was very nice data that was shown at this meeting on molybdenum surface states, which have very well understood two-dimensional surface state, and it has beautifully sharp spectral features, and it's well described by Fermi liquid theory. It doesn't exhibit superconductivity here once you're smearing above TC and sharp features below TC. Okay. Well, so certainly gives one some motivation to think about phases in which the electron decays, right, in which it doesn't have a sharp spectral feature, if you will. And so in particular, we've been sort of searching for a theoretical framework that can describe both Mott insulators, superconductors, and intervening quantum phases, both of the conventional flavor as well as exotic ones, in which the electron does decay. So referring to these as fractionalized. And with Leon and Chetan Nayak, we've essentially been developing what one might call a vortex field theory, where we, in some sense, have been starting thinking about being in this D-wave superconducting phase and trying to build up a theoretical description in terms of BCS vortices, HC over 2E vortices. These are the vortices that one could model, let's say, Matricon de Gen, I think, is the people that first looked at that, in a single BCS vortex. We've been developing, though, a quantum description where the vortices are promoted to a quantum field, and this is the creation operator for a vortex. And then we've been looking at, essentially, a quantum analog of the Kossuth-Thallus transition, where we are trying to imagine killing the superconductivity, destroying it, by unbinding vortex anti-vortex pairs. But we're trying to do this at zero temperature, because we're focusing here initially on quantum phases. So in fact, when one does this at zero temperatures, we'll see the vortices condense. And so you can, in fact, understand various insulators in terms of vortex condensates. And I think that's a rather a convenient thing to, a way to sort of describe different types of insulating phases. What I'll talk about towards the end, if I have time, is the Z2 gauge theory approach, which is essentially a dual mathematical description to this vortex field theory. It has a number of very nice features. In particular, it connects rather nicely to the antiferromagnetic phase. It also ties in rather closely to earlier gauge theories by Bhaskaran, others. I mean, Ian, who's here, I mean, there's a whole slew of people. I think Patrick Lee has been sort of the main person that's continued to push on these gauge theories, you know, which started some 10 years ago. But there is going to be a very, very crucial difference, we'll see, between the discrete Z2 gauge symmetry and these other continuous gauge symmetries. Okay, so let me just dive right in. Why vortices? Well, in quantum mechanics, the reason why it's mysterious is because basically we can describe things in terms of particles or in terms of waves. So in two dimensions, we have particles like electrons. We also have a wave-like description. If you're thinking in terms of bosons, it's perhaps a little simpler. One has some sort of many-particle wave function, and that many-particle wave function can have vortex singularities in it, where the currents are circulating around these vortices. And there's a beautiful identity which tells us, in fact, that the charge of the particle, let's say in this case the electron, and the flux that's quantized in the two-dimensional vortex, Q sub V, is equal to 1, product of these two.
Is this valid also in the
non-vortex? It is, yeah. I mean, if you try to develop a description in terms of the many electron wave functions, which is something we, you know, did, I'm not going to really be talking about that. To really implement it mathematically, what we did was to represent the electrons in terms of Chern-Simons bosons, and then we looked at vortices in the Chern-Simons boson. What's that?
Why do you use this relation for decomposition of flux and charge?
Where does this come from? It basically comes from the fact that where the quantization of vorticity comes from is the fact that when you take a particle, let's say this blue particle, around the vortex, the wave function of this particle, because it's quantum mechanical, has to be single valued, and so it can not change at all, but one thing it can do is change by 2 pi.
Okay, I think you
certainly do. Yeah, no, this is the first example.
Is that, if I'm doing the next line model and find the more seeds for the Thales Cossius transition and then make a transformation and you get charge, and then you simulate that? Now, you're going backwards. You're saying that the electrons
No, I'm not gonna. I'm really just trying to make a general point here. Which is that in order to try to understand fractionalization of charge or fractionalization of vorticity, we want to note this identity. That's all I'm saying at this stage. Okay. Let me give you two familiar examples, which is not what I'm going to be talking about, of two-dimensional fractionalization, which I think are well understood. The first is in a superconductor. This is vortex fractionalization. This is in the Ginzburg-Landau theory, if you will, but any description you develop will have the same feature. The electrons are paired, so the charge of the carrier, the Cooper pair, is 2e. So the vorticity is halved, essentially because of this identity, or if you will, when you take the charge 2e particle around an hc over 2e vortex, the wave function of the Cooper pair changes by 2 pi. Okay, we're also familiar with this example. Take it for granted. In the fractional quantum Hall effect, perhaps a little bit less familiar, one can think of, for example, the nu equals 1/3 state as involving a pairing of vortices. Well, actually, three vortices bind together. The glue here is the electron, which keeps them into this composite boson. So the charge of the vorticity of this composite object is 3 hc over e. And really, it's that reason, because this thing then condenses, that one ends up with a fractionalization of the electric charge. This is Laughlin's quasiparticle, 1/3 over E. So I'll come back to this later, but one can understand exotic electron fractionalized phases, spin charge separated insulators, and so forth, in terms of vortex pairing. That's the main message. So just as one can understand superconductivity in terms of electron pairing, one can understand exotic Mott insulators in terms of vortex pairing.
You will show us
now. Yeah. I assume you, and I just want you to take my word for it. I'm actually here. Yeah. Okay, so let me dive straight into the D-wave superconductor, because there will be vortices that you're all familiar with, sort of the vortices that one could describe in BCS theory. But let me first discuss a D-wave superconductor without any vortices in it. And so here's essentially the quasi-particle Hamiltonian, the usual kinetic energy, and the pairing term. And although it's not essential, let me just for simplicity focus on the nodal quasi-particles. So I linearize both the kinetic energy and the pair field near the nodes with two velocities, Vf and V delta. The important point here is I want to keep the phase of the pair field because I want to eventually be able to talk about vortices. And as you know, the nodal quasi-particles have a Dirac spectrum in a BCS description of a D-wave superconductor, and someone can introduce Dirac field if one so chooses, and it's described by some sort of Dirac equation. The most important point that I want to try to emphasize here is that the phase of the pair field, the phase of the Cooper pair field, is strongly coupled into the quasi-particle field. I mean, you can see that here, if you plug in this thing, it's E to the I phi times CC, and that's the same thing here, E to the I phi times a bilinear of these nodal quasi-particles. And so what I want to do now is just make a change of variables which decouples the phase fluctuations, decouples these phase variations from the quasi-particles. To do that, I want to first split the Cooper pair into two pieces. So E to the I phi can be thought of as a Cooper pair creation operator. It's like a bosonic field which creates the Cooper pairs. Strictly speaking, one should be thinking in terms of a rotor, a representation of the bosonic field. I want to write that as a square of another boson creation operator, B.
So in the Lagrangian that you wrote down earlier,
yeah, no, I'll add it in a moment. Yeah.
But
a that's it. Yeah, no, that's it. I didn't put it in, but I mean, I'll add it in momentarily. So here B creates a charge E excitation because it's half a Cooper pair. I'm assuming it's a singlet superconductor, so the Cooper pair doesn't carry any spin. So this boson doesn't carry any spin. It's going to be a boson, clearly, because the Cooper pair is a boson. So this has the quantum numbers of the holon. I'm not doping a Mott insulator here, and I think it's, for that reason, I'd prefer to call this thing a charge-on. In particular, it's more symmetrical with the spin-on, which I want to define over here. Anyway, so once I've got half of the Cooper pair sitting there, I can decompose the electron creation operator into half of a Cooper pair, or these charge-ons, and then I have to multiply it by something which creates the spin, which doesn't add any charge but adds some spin, and which better be a fermion, so the electron is fermionic, and so this is a spin-on. Has the quantum numbers of the spin-on as usually defined. So basically, it's sort of doing a spin-charge separation inside the superconductor. Although, as we'll see later, I don't have to be inside the superconductor to do this. So the reason why this is useful to do in the superconductor, and there's a number, and I'll try to show you, but the first is that E to the I phi times CC is this strong coupling between the phase fluctuations and the fermionic quasi-particles. If one changes variables to these charge-ons and spin-ons, then this strong interaction term just becomes a bilinear in terms of these spin-ons, which is very simple. So it's already at this stage that one can see a local, in fact, Ising-like gauge symmetry, which is entering, Z2 symmetry. But what's that symmetry? The symmetry is one can take the charge-on operator or the spin-on operator, if they think holon and spin-on, and one can change the sign of those operators. If one's on a lattice, one can change the sign at any point on the lattice. Okay, and that clearly has to leave the physical particles invariant, namely the Cooper pair and the electron, and it does, right? And so any effective theory that we develop in terms of these charge-ons and holons, charge-on and spin-ons, better have this underlying Z2 gauge symmetry.
Now in this context, the fact that you can talk about the local discrete symmetry is because it's crucial when you're living on a lattice, right? there's no...
Yeah, I mean, just...
limit.
Yeah.
The concept is kind of confusing.
Well, Nero, I mean... I mean, I think that's fine. Yeah, put it on a lattice. I mean, I can take that lattice spacing to be, you know, the string scale if I want, right? So, it's, you know, it's very short distance high energy physics, which I'm not interested in it. I mean, okay, here, Tony, I'm adding in the phase fluctuations, because now I want to write down the low energy effective theory for the D-wave superconductor, and the advantage of this change of variables is if I consider the... Now, a Dirac field made of these spin-ons, which carry the spin but not the charge, then the effective theory at low energies decouples into a spin sector. The quasiparticles at the nodes carry the spin but no charge, and the condensate of Cooper pairs, which carries the charge but no spin. And there are couplings between them, which are often very important and interesting, a Doppler shift type term, which probably is familiar to some of you. But technically, if one's focusing on the zero temperature properties inside the D-wave superconductor, these first two terms form a fixed point of a very simple renormalization group theory. Basically, it's just a quadratic theory. And these extra Doppler shift terms are, in fact, irrelevant.
What's the corresponding Hamiltonian of these?
It's basically a condensate of these, as we'll see. I mean, so it's basically you could write a Hamiltonian. Well, okay, that's what the Z2 gauge theory is basically. Inside the superconductor, you can just write a system of the Bs hopping on a lattice and make sure they are condensed, and that's this term. And the spin-ons are hopping on the lattice in such a way that their dispersion is that of the D-wave quasiparticles. Yeah, it's not really crucial to this. The reason it's nice is to think about it is because in a D-wave, one has to worry about, one has to sort of keep the quasiparticles in the theory, even at low energies, whereas in an S-wave superconductor, one could sort of say, they're not important.
Otherwise, the whole scheme works.
Yeah, no, it does. This change of variables...
Yeah,
this change of variables can be made in an S-wave superconductor.
So, actually, you have two degrees of freedom, relativistic bosons and relativistic...
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm confused by your answer to the question. I thought U-wave is too short so that you can have this Dirac stuff.
No, you wouldn't have a Dirac theory. Otherwise, these fermions would be gapped.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so for this particular form, I'm writing it for D-wave.
Now, at the level, this effect of Lagrangian doesn't play a role.
Well, it has to be there. It's actually, as we'll see. Well, I'll come to that in a moment. But the quantum phases, it turns out, are not fully specified by lower energy excitations alone, something which I find very disappointing. I always sort of believed in, but no longer do. So what I want to describe very briefly now is a pretty cute example of two different superconducting phases which have identical low energy physics, described, okay, by this effective Lagrangian, but which have different physics above a gap and which are very, very different type phases. So I can do two things, or I can do lots of things, but consider the two different phases that I can get out of this charge E, spin zero, charge on. Well, I can condense directly this charge E particle, getting what looks like a charge E condensate. Or I could pair the charge ons together to make something which has the quantum numbers of the Cooper pair, namely charge 2E, and I could condense that, leaving the single charge ons uncondensed. Now, both of these phases that I would describe this way are going to be superconducting because I'm breaking the electromagnetic U1 symmetry, which is carried by the only charged object in the theory at this point, which is the charge-on. Now, one of these two phases is the BCS superconductor that we all know and love, and the other one is sort of an strange, exotic superconductor.
At this level, I just want to understand a question of principle.
Not up to me. I mean, I'm free to do so.
Yeah. So, in principle, you can also say, look at a phase when B is zero, B squared is zero, but
the cube is zero. I know, but we know, okay.
But just guided by physical
charge 2E is kind of what we would expect for Cooper pair, so it wants to do that. Okay, so I can consider this thing as well, right?
I mean,
they have the same low energy physics because... This term which enters, you know, e to the I phi here is b squared. And so b is an expectation value, and it's a c number. B squared is the square of that c number. If b squared is an expectation value, it's just a c number. So either way, in either phase, it's just a number.
Right.
Well, let me take a poll on that, and then I'll try to answer that. So it turns out that, as I say, one of these two phases is that you get out this way is a conventional BCS superconductor, and the other one's kind of an exotic, bizarre phase, and maybe we don't even want to consider it. So let me take a poll. It's a question of whether the charge E condensate or the charge 2E condensate is the BCS superconductor. So how many people think a BCS superconductor is a charge E condensate of these charge-ons? And those that know the answer aren't allowed to vote, right? Like Sentul, I think. Yeah. And how many think the charge 2E? How many are too chicken to stick their necks out? 2E looks reasonable. Okay, so that's not the case. The charge E.
Now, the reason you said that the low-energy physics is the same is because your effect of Lagrangian doesn't even depend on B, right?
Yeah, well, no, it does. It depends on B through...
It's hidden somehow.
It's through... In a conducting phase, or a superfluid phase, the charge of the particle that's condensed, it doesn't really matter so much, right? It's only when you start putting in vortices that the charge starts mattering. So that's why. So whether it's a charge E or charge 2E, it's a little hard to tell when the charge is not even a good quantum number in the superconductor, right?
I think this example of superfluid in helium 4, there were some theories that it's not just one particle condensation. There is, in fact, a finite amount of pair condensation also.
Well, I mean, I think the analog is to think of helium 4 in terms of, you know, two protons, two neutrons, electrons, and ask, is helium 4 a six particle condensate, or can we think of a helium 4 superfluid as, you know, condensing the two protons and neutrons and then condensing the two electrons? Right, that's more analogous to what I'm talking about here, I think. So why is this charge E condensate a BCS superconductor? Well, that's what the gauge theory shows us very nicely, but I want to first emphasize that this charge E condensate breaks this Z2 gauge symmetry because, right, that locally was sending, if you want a lattice, BI to minus BI, right? So if this is an expectation value, it's clearly broken. So this Z2 gauge symmetry, in this way of thinking about it, the BCS superconductor is actually broken in addition to the U1 electromagnetic gauge symmetry. What are the excitations in the BCS superconductor? Well, there's an Anderson-Higgs plasmon. I mean, I didn't put in the long-range Coulomb interactions, but you could. That's the charge that would then become gapped, in three dimensions at least. The nodal quasiparticles, which are these spin-ons. And what about the electron spectral function in a BCS superconductor? Well, the electron spectral function at zero temperature in a BCS superconductor is sharp. There are electron states right above the gap, and one can add an electron into those, and it won't decay, at least if you add it to the points in momentum space where the excitations are the lowest energy. If you're thinking in terms of sort of photo emission, when you're knocking out an electron or adding an electron, if you add the electron, you're adding this charge on, you're adding a spin on, the charge on is condensed in the BCS superconductor, so you can replace it essentially by a C number, and when you looking at the electron spectral function inside the superconductor, inside a BCS superconductor, you're looking, in fact, at this spin-on spectral function, if you will, and that's described by this Dirac theory of just freely propagating spin 1/2 spin-ons, and so you expect a pole in the spectral function, and in fact, in experiments, it seems like that's what you're getting, a pole in the superconducting phase. But now I want to turn to really the important thing, which is vortices, okay? And these are going to be, at this stage, just the good old familiar HC over 2E BCS vortex, which you could, for example, describe in terms of a Bolger-Yugov-Degen type equation. But I want to really go beyond that. I want to develop a quantum mechanical description of both the vortices and the quasiparticles. And that's not really normally done.
Well, you could take a Higgs-Boson theory and quote that.
Well, okay, but the Higgs-Boson theory doesn't have any fermions in it. And that's the crucial thing. You see, I want to include fermions into the Ginzburg-Landau theory because I want to include quasiparticles and I want to know where the electron is. Where's the electron in Ginzburg-Landau theory? Yeah. Right.
No, but you can add it. It's not a problem. Just have the Higgs-Bosonian.
You can, but that's not the right thing to do. I mean, that's one of the... it's not a way to describe the interaction between that vortex, between the vortices in your Ginzburg-Landau theory and the fermions. And that's what I want to talk about now. So let me consider, in fact, that the fermions, the spinons, the electrons you want to be put back in, and a vortex, HC over 2E vortex. It's not really a vortex in the Ginzburg-Landau theory, because it's really a vortex in the full superconductor, which has electrons in there, but that's why I'm saying a BCS vortex, around which, when I take the phase of the Cooper pair, I pick up a 2π. The quasi-particles in a superconductor, the spinons, and the good old vortices in a superconductor have a long-range statistical interaction between them, which goes off to infinity. It's not something that's normally talked about. I was, in fact, told, well, at the Toronto meeting, I was just at that Steve Kivelson wrote this in a paper about 10 years ago, and he was delighted that someone was now thinking about it because no one had paid any attention. Anyway, I wasn't aware of that, and we'll duly reference him, of course. But I think he was right. I think it's so. What is a long-range interaction? Well, think of now sort of anyon physics, where you take one particle around the other, and it's a question of do you pick up a phase factor or not. So in particular, one can write the spin-on as the charge-on. Actually, I shouldn't have a dagger there. Times the electron. And the charge-on is a square root of a Cooper pair. So it's e to the I phi over 2. Right? It's not e to the I phi. It's e to the I phi over 2. So when phi winds by 2 pi around the vortex, phi over 2 winds by pi. So when one takes the spin-on around the vortex, since the electron itself certainly has to be single value with respect to the vortex, the spin-on will not be. And it will pick up a minus sign when it goes around the vortex. So one could refer to these things as relative semions. And so I want to emphasize, this is a completely general result which applies to any superconductor described by BCS theory, if you look at it carefully, is that the spin-carrying fermionic quasiparticles have a long-range interaction, infinitely long-range in some sense, with the BCS vortices, HC over 2E vortices. You can. It's because it's sort of this half-angular momentum quantum states, right? It's very weird stuff going on. And we're trying to disentangle that, really, with the Z2 gauge theory, actually. Rather than E, right? So I'll come back to that in a moment. And that's a great question. And it caught us up. Well, Central sorted it all out, and finally I understood who was telling me. Let's see if I can convey it to you. But before doing that, I think it will be, let me just mention this exotic fractionalized superconductor, DSC star, where one condenses a charge 2 condensate, that is a pair of these charge-ons, but leaves a single charge-on uncondensed. So this leaves the Z2 gauge symmetry unbroken, right? B going to minus B, but when you condense B squared, you're not breaking that symmetry. And this is the weird superconductor. Why is it weird? Well, what are the excitations? And this comes out of the Z2 gauge theory, which I'm probably not even going to have time to discuss very much. There's a plasmon. That's the same as in the conventional BCS superconductor. There's a nodal quasiparticles, the spinons. Well, there's another weird excitation in here. It's a gapped excitation which carries some discrete Z2 charge. We call it an ison. I don't think I want to discuss it particularly much, other than to say physically, I don't want to really focus on the vortices, what this thing is essentially a remnant of the unpaired charge-on inside the paired charge-on condensate. Right? So it's analogous to when, just thinking in old-fashioned BCS superconductivity, where you pair two electrons, you can ask, what about the excitation of an unpaired electron? Right? And that that doesn't have a conserved charge, but it does have a conserved discrete charge. Yeah, okay, so you want me to take it to short, Tony? I can tell Tony won't be satisfied. Okay, so this is the Cooper pair creation operator, EVI phi. So that's written as the square of this charge-on creation operator, right? So the charge-on creation operator is the square root of EVI phi. But you always have to worry about plus or minus the square root. That's something that confuses me still. So S is a number. It's going to be a quantum operator in the full quantum theory, but it's plus or minus 1. It takes two values. It's eigenvalues of plus or minus 1. And now condense the charge 2e object, e to the I phi, you can replace that by a C number, and then the charge on creation operator is just this Ising spin operator. And so in this weird D-wave superconductor, the electron, in fact, the spectral function would not have a pole in it, because if you add an electron, you add the charge of the electron, the spin of the electron, but there's something, some remnant of the charge of the electron which is left, this spin operator, which is carried as a separate excitation from these nodal quasiparticles. It's an excitation above the gap. And so if you add an electron, so just think physically, if you add an electron to a conventional superconductor, you're adding charge and spin. What happens normally is that the DCS superconductor, the charge is screened by the condensate, and spin is carried off as a quasiparticle. Well, in this weird phase, you add the electron, and there's a piece of the charge in some sense. It doesn't, it's not the U1 electromagnetic charge, but it's sort of this discrete Z2 charge, which moves off in one direction, and the spin of the electron moves off in the other, let's say. And so the electron would decay.
Does the kinetic energy term appear for S automatically?
This is all in the gauge theory, I mean, essentially. But I'm just sort of telling you the results at this stage.
No, S is a particle using some kinetic
energy. Yeah, no, it's going to have, no, it definitely has a kinetic energy. Yeah.
It's a boson.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a real scalar field, right? Like,
but it only picks up value plus or minus one.
Well, okay. That's true. So that's a real scalar field. Fine. It's values.
How did you find its derivative in energy?
Well, then you want to go on a discrete space-time lattice, and we'll do that, in a moment. I mean, probably. But what I really want to focus on is really what's happening to the vortices, and it turns out in this weird superconducting phase. And this comes back to, we'll come back to Rajiv's good question, is that the vortex itself, the BCS vortex, decays and splits into two pieces. It splits into a piece which is what you would have in a Ginzburg-Landau theory, which is just the screening currents floating around. That's, the U1 electromagnetic screening currents. Here it is, a U1 vortex. But in some sense, it's a bare vortex now, because there's another piece of the BCS vortex which, in fact, breaks off from it in this weird superconductor, which is a discrete Ising-like vortex, a Z2 vortex. Okay, and here in pictures is how you can have a charge E condensate and still have an HC over 2E vortex. So, I mean, I don't know if this is going to be clear, but this is supposed to represent a BCS vortex. This double cross is supposed to represent this sort of bare U1 vortex. And this cross with a circle in the middle is supposed to represent this discrete D2 vortex. So now let me think about the conventional BCS superconductor, okay? Conventional BCS superconductor, D-wave if you like. I'm talking about a charge E condensate, the charge on, the operator B. Okay, this is condensing. Okay, so what happens when we take the charge E charge on around this HC over 2E vortex? Well, it picks up only pi of phase, right? I mean, that's a problem. But
what's the blue dot? The blue dot
is left. No, the blue dot now is supposed to be the charge on.
The blue dot is the charge.
Yeah, sorry. And it has charge E. So when I take it around and a Ginzburg-Landau vortex, if you will, which has flux quantization HC over 2E. Because it's E going around 2E, it only picks up half of 2 pi. That is, it picks up a pi phase when it goes around. Okay. And if that was all there was to it, you'd be in trouble, because you can't have half a vortex sitting there in a condensed bosonic field. It will cost energy which grows infinitely with the size of the system. But it turns out that when you take the charge on, this charge E particle which is condensing, around this Z2 vortex, it also picks up a pi. This is in the Z2 gauge theory. It turns out. I'm just giving you the answers in some sense, Tony.
Yeah.
Right, so, okay.
I'm just giving you a word for
it. Good.
Yeah. I mean, but there is a proof. I mean, you can.
Yeah, no, you can see it mathematically in terms of, field theories that you would like. Well, the Landau-Ginzburg description of a D-wave superconductor doesn't have fermions in it.
No, but it doesn't have fermions, but it should have this...
Well, no, okay, if you don't have fermions and you only have, you build up a theory in terms of charge 2e bosons, you can't even talk about a charge e particle. So all the subtleties are when you try to remember that, hey, in a superconductor there are electrons in there, and we want a quantum mechanical description, and we want to in fact kill the superconductivity at some point, we have to ask, what are the electrons doing? Right? So we have to really go much beyond the Ginzburg-Landau way of thinking about it.
Fairly standard if you just make a public Fermi transformation, and then you have a sort of one electron problem in the field of
sure, and that's
in the field, and then you have both electrons, and this field has its more
sure, that's yeah, so if this is a different way of describing that same physics.
Yeah.
But you can ask yourself...
You want to sum over all possible, pick out the relevant physical situations of these fermions and these
well, no, but if you think about it this way, and this is what think about it that way, take your HC over 2E vortex,
yeah,
and just put one of them, a BCS, just put one of them there, and take the many electron wave function, and take an electron in the wave function and drag it all the way around. Well, let me first drag a Cooper pair all the way around that vortex. Well, the phase of the many electron wave function will wind by 2 pi, right? That's because it's a good old vortex. What happens when you take a single electron all the way around? No, I'm taking a charge E. I mean, I'm taking the electron, let's say a single spin up, around an HC over 2E vortex. What happens? Maybe the electron wave function changes sign? That's a usual guess from theorists. Experimentalists know that can't happen when I've pulled on this one. The electron wave function has to be single valued. Okay, so it starts getting confusing. And that's when you start thinking about that, you realize there's something subtle going on. Right?
It depends on the flux.
It's probably a little ill-defined question. I mean, it probably depends in detail on where all the other electrons are on this wave function, and it's very, very, very sensitive to that. And
the thought experiment just said is usually given as Cooper confined. There's a single charm, but
it's yeah, but this is the...
That's one way of saying
I'm condensing these charged objects. I'm not... I'm talking about... Okay. Oh, fine. Okay, so you... Oh, I'm not sure much... Yeah, so what you were saying, fine, okay, so I think I understand what you're saying. So if you condense a charge E object, you confine these two types of vortices together.
Right,
yeah, exactly. Sure.
It,
yeah, no, exactly. So this is... Exactly, so without knowing it, perhaps, if you want to think about it, this, an HC over 2E BCS vortex is already a confined... You know, we can look inside it, in some sense, and find two...
But there's no way for me to understand its transparency unless you tell it to advise on.
Well, I've told you, it's something when I take this charge and around, it changes sign, but there are no electromagnetic screening currents going around. Right, that's what it is. It's going to be a topological. It's going to be a topological defect in the Z2 gauge theory that will emerge shortly.
I have some misunderstanding with it. When you talk about physics and two-dimensional, let's say, boson fermions, it seems to be by saying that you change the two particles, and then wave functions still acquire some
data. Yeah.
You can find it by doing it again.
Yeah.
Plus or minus one. When you drag the particle around the vortex, and go back.
It's one particle around another particle. It's two. They're 2-point like excitations,
right,
in the theory.
The
yeah, they're different. A and B.
No.
Right.
Let me ask
you.
Now you come back to wave function, which may differ by any phase factor, because the state described by the wave function is defined after phase. So how do you explain it should be single value? It's not an
argument. I'm not saying it should be single value. In fact, it's not. Right. If you, I'm saying the electron, the physical, the electron wave function is a single value. That's the only thing that has to be single value. Now, the electron wave function is a single value because you just write the many particle Hamiltonian, you know, get all the eigenstates, and it's just
but
a.
No, but that's the argument that people used to give to say any
electron. When and you, Tony, in any of your papers, in the quantum Hall effect, you use the constraint that the electron has to be single valued with respect to all the various excitations to, in fact.
Because it's a physical.
Exactly. Okay. And likewise, these weird particles can still exist. I mean. Fine. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah. But I. Fine. Good. I didn't. I'm sorry. Was that what you were saying? No, I didn't think so. But.
I don't see why the space factor should be equal to one.
Right. Which?
What's the current one? Let's use that I have this work, and that is from Gomaron of experiment high energy. I definitely will see it.
notable, just high energy, 1 MeV electron on the wonderful magnetic wall.
Yes.
So the outer side of Simon Marono, which carries minus one to single electron.
But the electrons in that system, the quasi particles above the gap.
I don't care about what, okay. Just probe electron, external probe electron.
This is. In the BCS description that's coming out of this, being described in rather foreign language, all the predictions that you will get out of BCS theory are going to be reproduced here. Okay, so if you don't even have to think about it this way if you don't want, and at this stage it may be not even useful, but it gets useful when you when we go on. What's that?
What's wrong with sine minus one for fermion when I drag it around the...
It's wrong if it's an electron, because the yeah, it's a physical electron. The electron wave function is a single valued. Right, solve, you know, the Schrodinger equation. I mean, the gauge invariant phase. Yeah. Okay, but we don't have any electromagnetic fields there, right? Not sure. Okay. I can't answer all the questions at once, but in fact, so I think I'll annihilate those questions and just go on. Is that okay? You can. I'm sorry, because otherwise, well, otherwise I just don't think I'll. Because what's behind this is actually a very careful theory, which Senthil has worked out all the details and you know dragged me along, kicking and screaming. And you know one can dot the I's and cross the T's on you know regularizing the theory on a lattice and everything, give meaning to all these statements. And it's putting it into hand waving to pictures so that everyone can understand it that makes people a little uncomfortable because it's sort of and I understand that and it should. I mean because it's. In fact, maybe I should. Well, okay, very quickly. If we want to kill the superconductivity now, so I'm in the conventional BCS superconductor that you all know and love. I want to unbind BCS positive and negative HC over positive and negative circulation HC over 2E vortices. Let them move around in a quantum analog of Clausewitz Thallus, and at zero temperature, this vortex destruction operator has to condense. That scrambles the phase of the superconducting pair field in the usual way, just as in Clausewitz Thallus. That kills the superconductivity. Okay, whether or not you actually go into a mod insulator depends a bit on what. Whether or not you're commensurate with some underlying lattice or not. Let me assume you are, let's say, an undoped situation. Then one expects when we're going to a mod insulator.
Why mod insulator? Why not ordinary metal?
You might go into ordinary metal, yeah. Very interesting. But I'm not going to be talking about that. Yeah. So due to the long-range statistical interaction between what? Between the BCS HC over 2E vortex and the spin-on, when one condenses the HC over 2E vortex, one gets confinement. It is a confinement transition. And what gets confined together are two spin-ons to make, let's say, a spin-1 object. I think it was a magnon, I guess. Or a spin-on and a charge-on to make an electron. Or you can, you know, make a Cooper pair. Or, I mean, you can make anything with the quantum number of the electron. That gets left in the spectrum. So this is totally directly analogous to at least, I think, simple examples where you can understand quark confinement in terms of monopole condensation. Here one's doing vortex condensation. Well, that's sort of the 2+1 dimensional version of that. Right? And it's really, okay.
Well, that's why I thought the electrons confined. And only the Cooper pair
exists. No. So here what it is, the weird spin, the weird quasi-particle in the superconductor, which carries spin but no... Okay, but... The spin-on in the superconductor, the quasi-particle in the superconductor, and these charge-y objects that I defined get glued together to give you the form of the electron. So the transition out of a superconductor into, let's say, out of a D-wave superconductor into a mod insulator, I think should correctly be thought of as a confinement transition, and it can be extremely non-trivial, the quantum transition. Very briefly, if you pair the vortices, comes back to we were discussing earlier, if you choose to pair the vortices, to take two of these BCS vortices, put them together and condense the pair, but leave the single vortex uncondensed, then you still kill the superconductivity because you have vortices moving around, but when you take the spin-on around a single HC over 2E vortex, so this must be a spin-on, so thinking in the superconductor, his HC over 2E vortex, you get a minus sign. If you take it around two of them, so another HC over 2E vortex, you don't get a minus sign. Right, minus 1 squared is 1. Okay, so this thing together is it's an HC over E vortex. And if I condense that, there's no long-range cyclical interaction with the spin-on. The spin-on just lives and survives, right? And so that it survives as a spin 1/2 fermionic quasi-particle excitation. Which
according to your theory, you should get kind of singular response in the particle-particle channel as you approach the monitor.
And I'm sure there's going to be some singular response. Yeah, yeah. I don't think I want to be now. I'm sure I probably could try, but it just takes me a little far afield. I mean, I'm not trying to. That's a good question for sure. I mean, I don't really understand this confinement transition very well, actually. It's an extremely complicated transition, really. Almost certainly. But anyway, in this weird, so one ends up with, if one condenses pairs of vortices, a strange fractionalized, spin liquid, nodal liquid, we called it. Obviously it smells very much like the D-wave RVB states, and, in some sense is that, but I think now I'm understanding it in a way, I think it's giving us a physical understanding, at least, and seeing that it's actually a stable quantum phase in which one, which can exist, and one doesn't have to worry about some sort of gauge fluctuations destroying it. No, it's an insulator. It doesn't, no, the charge, it doesn't, no, I mean, it's an electrical insulator. Yeah. So, the charge stiffness is, zero. I mean, it's, right. But it has fermionic spin 1/2 charge neutral particles, spin-ons, okay, living at the nodes, if one was doing this in the D-wave case, which can move. In addition to the charge-ons, which still, in fact, go on living then. That's the other excitation you get now. I mean, you need that because you know the electrons in the spectrum, or you started with an electron, excuse me. You know you have to be able to build a physical electron up. If you have a charge zero spin 1/2 particle, you obviously need a charge E spin zero particle to build back the electron. So one has that, that's the charge on, that's still there, or the hole on in that nomenclature. In addition, one has a Z2 vortex, there's a vison, which I alluded to earlier, and which is the thing which was bound to the, that was part of the BCS vortex, and it lives as a gapped excitation in this phase. And what is it? Okay, now I'm doing the same square root that I did earlier, right, with the plus or minus one of the square roots, but I'm doing it now in terms of the vortices. I did it before in terms of the charges when I was looking at the D-wave, DSC star, this weird D-wave superconductor. Just sort of forget about that. Look at a vortex pair operator. You can write the vortex operator as plus or minus the square root of the pair operator. V is plus or minus 1 because it's a vortex. That's why vortex spin, if you will, Ising-like spin. When you condense the pair, that you can replace this by a C number. And so what was the BCS HC over 2E vortex in the superconductor, or a piece of it, if you will, it was the Z2 piece of it survives when you kill the superconductivity in this particular way by pairing BCS vortices and condensing them. So this vison, we call it, because it's sort of an Ising-like vortex, is essentially the remnant of the unpaired HC over 2E vortex, which survives an insulator. It's a piece of it. Yes. It was a confined object, and it's one sort of part of it. So that's sort of physically what this Z2 vortex is, and how it can emerge.
So the Z2 vortex is something defined on lattice, is that some plus or minus, some configuration plus or minus?
Yeah, okay, well, you can.
Is that topological? I mean, something you can draw?
Yeah. Yeah, in a gauge field, in a Z2 gauge theory, yeah. So this This Vython is absolutely basic to the whole Z2 gauge theory, and I think to thinking about non-insulated actually, and is that it's the an Ising-like excitation which is when it's unbroken, it can remain unbroken if we're condensing pairs of vortices, then one has spin charge separation, like in the nodal liquid. If you break the Ising symmetry by ordering this Vison, condensing the Vison, that's like condensing a single BCS vortex, and that leads to confinement. Okay. I guess that was up. I don't know what.
Confinement of what?
Yeah, the spin and charge back into the electron. Yeah. Yeah, so it's really, well, what did Tehuft say about the SU2 symmetry that it's the Z2 piece that is an important one for confinement? Okay, will you please just say, give Tony the sentence.
Center of confinement.
Which is what's important, and it's the Z2 in this case. You can look at some SU2 gauge theory or some U1 gauge theory, and it's really the Z2 piece of it, which is what's important. Let me see. Well, at this stage, I could talk about basically the gauge theory, which underlies these results in some sense. It underlies the results. Or I could quit.
Do you want to give a summary and then all those
people
want to
move on? Okay. Summary.
There's a lot. Maybe next week.
It's all just the mathematics behind the physics. Sorry. I guess the conclusions are that at least that some of us are finding it very useful to think in terms of quantum vortices when one's trying to understand strongly correlated electrons in two dimensions, or in three dimensions, where they become loops. And those vortices, they have a Z2 piece, and that's a vortex in a Z2 gauge theory, in fact, that one can be thinking about as well. And it gives one some sort of framework for describing strongly correlated physics, including conventional phases that one, knows enough. So one doesn't have to believe there's exotic physics, or exotic phases present, I think, for you to perhaps be convinced that this formulation, which I haven't had time to just tell you about, it might actually be useful. But I think this formulation does allow for and give a theoretical description of electron fractionalization, spin charge separation. The reason partly I don't want to call it spin charge separation is because you can do this with spinless electrons. Pair spinless electrons to make a Cooper pair and do the same exercise. And then it's not spin charge separation, it's energy charge separation, I suppose, right? What's important to it, as far as I can tell, is that there is a underlying Z2 gauge theory in that case as well, and it's that Z2 gauge theory has, of course I haven't had time to talk about it, has two phases, a confining and a deconfining phase, and when you go into the deconfining phase, you can get these fractionalized physics out. You can understand that equivalently in terms of pairing of vortices. More generally, if you don't want to pair vortices, one can think about Mott insulators, in fact, all insulators, I think, in terms of vortex condensates. And I think it's that in some sense gives one an order parameter for a hidden order inside the insulator, which normally one doesn't sort of think about. Let me just stop there. I guess that's...
Did I see you right there that the
Vison
are gapless excitations?
No, depends what. There's critical points where they would be gapless. At a transition from, let's say, a D wave superconductor into a conventional antiferromagnet, if you want to describe things in terms of these Visons, they'd be gapless, right, at the critical point. But. They they typically are either gapped or, I mean, because they're described by an Ising model, ultimately. So it's sort of a 2 plus 1 dimensional sort of quantum Ising model, which you can, in two space dimensions and imaginary time, becomes just a 3-dimensional space-time lattice, but a 3-dimensional Ising model. And that Ising model, you know, typically is either in its paramagnetic phase or its ferromagnetic phase. You know, there's an isolated critical point. And the Ising spin, there is this Vison. And so in the ferromagnetic phase, the Vison, which is the Ising spin, picks up a non-zero expectation value.
That, you're not suggesting it's parallel to the D or something like that. It's still kind of a non-influence.
Okay, so well, in the nodal liquid, there are low-energy excitations, which are these the spin-ons, carried, which carry spin, but no charge, and live, you know, the remnant of the nodal quasiparticles of the D-wave superconductor, which have survived when you kill the superconductivity in a particular way. It's not, you know, in a way that goes into this nodal liquid phase, right? So, you know, where might the nodal liquid exist, if anywhere, in the phase diagram that cooperates? It would be in the underdoped region. And if it's going to be there, I think it would be, you know, where is it? Well, there's two things to say on this. It might be here. But actually, even if it's not here, it may well be that the physics underlying the sort of the spin and charge separation, which might be going on here, could be, I think if spin and charge occurs, I think it's generically going to occur at electron volt scales, I mean, high energy scales, unless you're near some critical point. And so if that's true, sort of the nodal liquid physics would be a useful way to think about perhaps this sort of pseudo-gap regime of fine temperature, even though ultimately you may be going superconducting. There may be a critical, there may be a critical regime here you have to worry about and so forth. I mean, but as far as quantum phases actually existing in the nodal liquid doesn't have long-range antiferromagnetic order. It's not a superconductor. Okay, so this is, and it, you know, and it, I should say it's sort of in, interpolates rather naturally between this phase and that phase. So you know, this is where we would suggest that one might look. I mean, the type of experiments one would be looking for would be to, for example, do thermal transport in the very underdoped region and trying to see if you can get thermal transport from these gapless spin-ons. Okay, so there's been a lot of beautiful now, in fact, this is the main emphasis of this meeting I was at, of thermal transport and other experiments, but looking at the D-wave quasiparticles inside a D-wave superconductor, and which contribute this sort of universal value to kappa over T, the ratio of the thermal conductivity to temperature. And people are only starting to, and now, you know, planning to do so more carefully, look at thermal transport, both in the very underdoped superconductors and in, you know, above, both above and below TC, and in this region as well. So I think that would be interesting. The other thing I should say, in the nodal liquid, I mean, say this spectral function is smeared because the electron decays into the charge on and the spin on. And I mean, that's really okay. So that, let me just then, maybe I should just say that, because that I think is really, and that comes out to sort of a nice experiment here, is that, and this is something that, I mean, Patrick Lee, I think, has in effect been saying all along, and maybe it goes back to Bhaskaran and others. I mean, you'll see that. Okay, we're right decomposing the electron in terms of the charge and the spin. And the electron spectral function, you know, this imaginary part of the Green's function, and the Green's function is some, you know, CC, you know, electron correlator. So if one has spin charge separation, that is, if these guys move off at separate excitations, this thing becomes, you know, essentially decouples at low energies in terms of a, you know, charge on spectral function and the spin-on spectral function, and one has to do a convolution actually when one comes back to momentum space. and energy space, and that's what would give the smearing of the electron-spectral function. Okay, so but what if one actually so has spin and charge separated in this way in the normal state, effectively? As one goes into the superconductor, I'm sure I've convinced you, but I've at least stated, is that the conventional BCS superconductor is where this boson, the chargeon, is condensing. And so in that case, electron Green's function in the superconductor, this becomes average value of D squared times the spin-on spectral function. And so this is just a number, right? And it tells you it's a number which is basically proportional to the strength of the superconductivity, proportional to TC, increases with increasing TC. And so inside the superconductor, when you measure the electron spectral function, you're really measuring a spectral function something which is proportional to these spin-ons, and the coefficient of proportionality should increase when the superconductivity gets stronger as TC goes up. Right, and that is a feature of this data. I mean, in fact, and this is not just the Shen's group at Stanford. This is also almost identical results from Campuzano's photo emission data at Argonne. Is that as you underdope, going from optimally dope superconductor underdope, the weight under this peak shrinks down. And so this is going, from TC of 90 degrees down to TC 25 degrees. I don't know. I suggested he look at that. He said he thought that'd be an interesting thing to do. It's gonna be a little hard to see because if you believe that's what's happening, this peak is sort of disappearing in the noise. Or maybe it's really disappearing, but I think it's just losing. I mean, it's not really broadening, it doesn't look like, it's just losing weight under the peak, right? Which is exactly what you would expect. Yeah, no, but as a function of temperature, it doesn't do anything very dramatic. You see, 10 or 15 degrees above TC, the spectral function is very smeared, okay? And it turns out, and people are now doing very, very careful experiments on this, when you get into the regime where it looks like essentially the critical regime for the transition, where you're starting to sort of get, Coslet Thales phase type fluctuations, probably, you start getting this peak. And then as you go into the superconductor, this peak comes up. And
D squared is the order parameter of the
BCSK. Yeah.
That is separately measured, right?
Yeah, well, actually, just strictly speaking, this would be the condensate fraction, which isn't measured.
No,
that's the superfluid density. Right? I mean, there's a subtle difference, right? Think of helium-4, right? In helium-4, the superfluid density equals the total density, right? Yeah. But, okay, fine. But, that's, nitpicking. The data is not at the level we're doing that. So just take B squared, B average squared. This is basically measured experimentally. Well, this we measure. This is measured. Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. That's your point. And actually, it's proportional to TC. Very nicely so, in fact. But
also changes the function of temperature.
Actually, what one needs is not the superfluid density. That's the thing. It's this. And okay. Yeah. Okay. I don't know how quickly this thing, turns. Well, it's probably three-dimensional x y critical behaviors it turns on. Which is rather narrow, and then it builds up. And it may not actually. Nodal quasiparticles. They deplete rho s. I don't know about how to think about it. I don't know if I've ever thought about that. Do they deplete the condensate fraction? That's true even without the nodal quasiparticles, right? Because in helium-4, there's no fermions, presumably, we have to worry about. And so, no, for sure, this doesn't have to be, this is not Galilean invariant, so this doesn't have to be the full density, and certainly isn't. It's x rather than 1 minus x, and that's part of the mystery, right? This thing won't be, it is not going to be necessarily scaling with the superfluid density at all. But I guess what I'm wondering about is if one assumes it has some value and then asks at very low temperatures what are its corrections due to the nodal quasiparticles, no one's ever thinks about it because you can't measure it, right?
It's not like a gas function.
I mean, within BCS theory, everything is equal to everything else, pretty much, right? And it's right. I mean, the order parameter is the gap, is the superfluid density. Yes, is it? Probably is. Yeah. Okay, so well, it does. That's the way I motivate it. It doesn't really. What it has, okay. Take you know, the action or Lagrangian for your SU2 gauge theory in terms of maybe Fs and Bs, right? And add to that a term which is F up, F down. And this thing, which is allowed by the physical symmetries, namely electromagnetic U1, so this is, you know, electromagnetic U1, right, because these are neutral, so it doesn't destroy charge, and it's allowed by SU2 spin, you know, rotational invariance, not some weird gauge. It's not allowed, if you will, by some SU2 gauge symmetry, but that's not a physical symmetry anyway. So these SU2 gauge theories and the U1 gauge theories have enlarged the redundancy in the theory, and they've enlarged it more than we're choosing to enlarge it, right? And you know, if you enlarge it that much, there's not, you know, in this term would be allowed, sort of, and you know, it would be there, right? So now in a lot of these theories, though, one considers spin-on pairing, where this only occurs when, you know, this, you only sort of get this term when this picks up a non-zero average. But this term's allowed in the Hamiltonian, so you know, you've directly broken that symmetry, yeah, maybe the SU2 gauge symmetry, right from the, you know, the physics. Yeah. And now there isn't an equivalent quantity, at least I can think of, that you can add that would break this Z2 gauge symmetry. I mean, at least I hope there isn't. I mean, you know, I can't. Well, because this is why this is Z2 gauge invariant, because that's just letting F go to minus F, right? But and you can't add, you know, a term just linear in F. Okay, that would be bad news. And you can't add a term linear in B. That's right. So it's spin rotation. So charge conservation means that you have to have sort of quadratic terms in B, and so that's Z2. And the fact that the that you need a bilinear in terms of fermions protects, I think, the Z2 in the fermionic and in the spin-on sector. So. So it, I mean, it's certainly, you know, very close. I mean, the Z2 gauge is, you know, really very close in spirit, and you know, and reasonably close in mathematical detail to these other gauge theories. That, but it's, well, there's a couple of things about it. I mean, the main thing is you don't need to enlarge the symmetry so much. This is a much simpler gauge symmetry. It's discrete. And it can have two phases, a deconfined and a confining phase, in 2+1 dimensions, which at least the U1 gauge theory look like, you know, naively they do not have. More than that, though, this Z2 gauge theory, and I didn't have time to talk about this, is dual to the 2+1 dimensional Ising model, you know, which is something we understand extremely well, of course, and which is essentially the 3D, you know, classical Ising model. And the Ising spins in this weird Ising model are these bison, these, you know, Z2 vortices. So it's much, much, much simpler, and it also allows us to understand and control, you know, spin charge separation, which looked like it perhaps wasn't even possible in the theory with the more redundant description. No, but I mean, we can put in the, you know, we can calculate in the context of the models, we can calculate what the electrical conductivity looks like, and you know, the.
Can you envision this kind of different?
Totally.
I mean, this language allows you to have many different.
Yeah, no, it. I mean, I haven't. It describes. Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, it. I should have. Okay, so let me just throw out one phase diagram because
that. Global phase diagram.
Well. I mean, I don't know, you know, what actual phases are there in the real physical system is very, you know, sensitive to details, which we don't have our hands on. But well, that's a very good question. And
can you also say that what is actually the symmetry?
Yeah, the symmetry is in a dual vortex description. There's a U1 symmetry, which is the conserved circulation, and when you break that U1 that symmetry is broken. That gauge symmetry is broken in a Mott insulator. It's directly analogous to the breaking of electromagnetic U1 symmetry in a superconductor. Right, that's how you describe it. That's right. The way you distinguish. Let me explain it again. You distinguish between a Fermi liquid and a superconductor by saying, okay, this is the condensate of some, particle, pair field, where this is Cc equals zero. Okay? A Mott insulator is a condensate of a vortex. This is a dual. You just think in terms of a dual language, and particles at a vortices is what superconductivity is to insulating properties, and the Fermi liquid is some weird beast in the middle, in fact, in which both the particles and the vortices are fluctuating, and neither one is condensing. That's what, effectively, the Fermi liquid is the strangest phase. Free fermions are really is the weirdest phase of all. Well, okay, so we've, spent a lot of hard effort trying to start from a description in terms of underlying electronic degrees of freedom, fermions, the electrons, and doing, manipulating the effective theory, in order to identify various vortices that we can work with. So what I've been talking about, and what seems to be perhaps the simplest and most conceptually simple for many people, is to imagine a local pair field, even if it doesn't have appreciable magnitude. It could have an infinitesimal magnitude, but you can still think about it, and you can talk about the phase, the vortices in that pair field, right? Its local amplitude could be, tiny. No. So there's another long paper we had where we started with electrons, and I wanted to talk directly, get as close as I could to working in terms of vortices in the electron wave function. So you can, in two dimensions, you can write this as a spinful boson. That's not the charge on. I should call it something else. But times some, Chern-Simons, gauge field, and then you can develop the whole theory working in terms of vortices in these bosonic fields, and all these formulations. So that's two formulations we work through. One is you work in terms of vortices in the superconductor. The second is you work in terms of vortices in the, it's essentially in the electron, but it's in this Chern-Simons boson, so almost the vortices in the electron. And the third is you work with the Z2 gauge theory. And we've also shown that these two are, directly dual to each other, and these are equivalent. So we've sort of coming at it from all different directions and, being confused as we go along. But basically, you sort of pick your favorite way of thinking about vortices, and I think you can incorporate it and show the equivalence. Because it's really just sort of quantum mechanics, particles and vortices, and that's it. Of these three sort of formulations of this way of thinking about this physics, which are all qualitatively equivalent, the Z2 gauge theory has the distinct advantage that we can do things most carefully on a lattice, starting with familiar looking Hubbard and spin type models. To get to these, we have to do duality transformations, which are basically controlled, but you introduce a core term for the vortex, and there's not fudging, but you're not really doing, you're not sort of rigorous mapping from one model to another. And that doesn't actually bother me, because the model you're starting with is just a caricature of the physics anyway, but it bothers everyone else. Because people think the Hubbard model is, you know, God-given, and the TJ model is even more so.
So
probably, yeah. Well, there would be vortex loops in that case. Yeah. Yeah, no, you can think about helium force in helium force superfluid, right? There's the okay, this would be superfluid, not superconductive, but it doesn't really matter. You're condensing the helium force. But the roton, you know, in Feynman's I don't know who thought of it. Is Feynman originally a roton? No. I don't know who got Landau. Excuse me, Andrew. Feynman's energy was lower or something, wasn't it? He was very proud of himself, I think, Feynman in this one. But the roton, I can think of it correctly, I think, in terms of a vortex ring, you know, quantized vortex ring. And if there was a continuous transition from the superfluid, which is where we are here, to a solid, which there isn't, but if there were, this would presumably come down to zero,
yeah,
right?
You have nothing to do with superconductivity. It's simply shorter and shorter than
energy. But let me just make the point. This is let me make a point. Can I make the point? So sorry. This is a vortex loop. It's got a finite energy cost. If it was a continuous transition into the solid, as you approach the solid, like a Mohn-insulator, approaching the Mohn-insulator, the vortex loops proliferate and condense. And that quantizes the helium-4 atoms, the charge. Right? And so you can think about a solid or a Mohn-insulator, solid helium-4, Mohn-insulator of electrons, all in terms of in two dimensions in terms of vortex condensates, or in three dimensions, three special dimensions in terms of vortex loop condensates. In fact, you know, that's really what...
Couldn't you think of the electron, then, of vortices in electromagnetic field? I mean, that's what J.J. Thompson...
No, but that's sources of the electromagnetic field.
The singularities of the electromagnetic field, and...
Well, they're sources of the electromagnetic field. Yeah, but they're not... I don't think, okay. I mean, that's sources, right? But it's a different...
As a source, you believe that they are sort of... exist, and then they produce an electromagnetic field. While J.J. thought that there was a field.
Uh-huh.
Electromagnetic field, and it has some singularities, and that was what the electron was.
Okay. Okay, and so in fact, okay, that's interesting, because that, I mean, in these vortex representations, the electron is the defect.
Yeah.
So, okay, that's the point you're making. That's interesting. So we're sort of, we're about 100 years late, is what you're saying. Well, I think, okay, to think about that transition, I think you have to know what phase you're going into. Okay, so you want to be going into a conventional antiferromagnet. We don't have a theory of that. I mean, that's what we need. I mean, we need to know how to describe a dope Mohn insulator. If we can't describe that, how can we describe the transition? Okay, in infinite D, you know, okay, I'm not sure the connection between this and infinite D. I mean, if there is any, I'm not, that's a good question. I'm not,
what you're suggesting is something beyond the single particle level. And infinite D, you talk about the monster and the single particle physics.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's right.
That's very unnatural in infinite D because there are no single particle precursors to transitions in general. You just separate them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so this may be, yeah, it's just, you know, I mean, ultimately, if we understood that, you know, how to underdope and eventually, you know, approach the Mott state of a dope Mott insulator, we would, you know, it doesn't matter which way we describe it, it would, you know, we should, but we don't know how to describe it, I think. And, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, the Brinkman-Rice, there are ways of thinking about it, and, you know, that's, Well, that's sort of a, you know, it's a mean field way of thinking about something, and I, but there's, you know, there's another way of thinking about another way of thinking about it is in terms of nesting of a Fermi surface, right? And, you know, at weak you have a model, right? With perfect nesting and half filling, you open up you gap out the whole Fermi surface and you have a antiferromagnet, and then you dope and you get little Fermi pockets. I mean, it seems to me that's the correct description in sort of coming from Fermi liquid way of thinking about it, right? It's small u physics, maybe small u physics survives, but you would then, when you dope the fully gapped Fermi surface, you would start developing little Fermi pockets where you just have, you know, lambda quasi particles living there.
These things are insulated above the negative.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons it suggests, you know, the fact that they're insulated is up at electron volts or higher, and only kind of weak magnets suggest charge and spin are doing different things. That's, you know, that's the basic idea, in some sense, underlying charge-spin separation. Charge gaps start forming in electron volts, spin ordering.
Spin is a side effect, presumably.
It's a side effect. I agree with that. And so I think, in fact, okay, this is just my personal bias, I'm going to be totally off base on this. Focusing entirely, not entirely, but almost entirely on the antiferromagnet and trying to dope that and thinking spin physics is missing the physics. I think charge physics, and I think it's up at high scales, electron volts. We have to understand that. You know, think about, you know, an optimally dope up to 1,000.
Do you have a language? Is this language useful to do that?
Okay, well, it's useful. I'm hoping so. I mean, I. What's that?
Can you see the collapse of the charge gap as you vary some parameters continuously?
I mean, I think. What's that?
I mean, it's close to zero. There's no gap against charge implications in the metallic phase.
Okay, so you might say, how can we describe a metal doing this?
Yeah.
And the metal. It's a very strange thing, but actually, okay, this is also what I think in order. This is where I want to go next. I mean, besides, you know, thinking about this stuff more, is rather than starting here and going this way, we've been doing this and going that way, I want to do this and go this way, actually. And I want to understand going from a superconductor to a metal. And I think that may tell us something about what's happening up here. I would describe it as coming out of a superconductor as a confining transition, confinement. At strong coupling. It gives us insulating phase if we assume we're commensurate with some underlying lattice, so we have one charge per site. You know, that's one of the challenges, I think, is, you know, in BCS theory, coming out of a Fermi liquid, where's the transition from the metal to the superconductor? It's really the transition is in the metal, in some sense, right? It's, you know, then you put on this, the, you know, weak attractive interaction, and you get, it drives, you know, BCS type pairing. It's not out of the question to me that there is a strong interacting fixed point, quantum critical point, in which there's a transition from a superconductor to a metal, right? And the normal metal is a normal metal. I mean, I can hand wave, and to actually describe it is hard mathematically, but I can describe it. It's essentially a critical phase, which it is. I mean, there are parallel correlations in a Fermi liquid, and it's a critical phase in which neither the electrons nor the vortices, that is, neither the particles nor the waves, are behaving classically.
Is it ever a fixed point? Or
yeah, no, we understand the Fermi liquid fixed point extremely well. That's a fixed point phase, and the only, the marginal parameters of the lambda Fermi liquid parameters, and the only relevant perturbation from that is, you know, the BCS attractive interactions. That's a fixed point phase. I mean, it's a fixed point describing a phase, the Fermi liquid fixed point. We have a BCS fixed point describing a superconductor, which, you know, we basically understand, but I think there's subtleties in terms of these vortices and quasiparticles, which are, you know, massive gapped excitations, which we perhaps haven't thought so carefully about, actually. And then, you know, we understand other various other fixed points. The nodal liquid is a fixed point describing a spin charge separated phase, and but.
So that is with regard to the experiment. Is your suggestion that the spin metal to deviate superconducting transition is also a deconfining transition, or not?
Yeah, no, I haven't talked about this with you, Sento, but I think, I don't know, this is, I think one might be able to understand this as the critical point just from a superconductor to a metal. That's strong coupling, strong interactions with a confinement transition. I mean, we, but it's pretty vague, and I don't know, I mean, it may just be totally off. But, you know, people talk about, well, this looks quantum critical. You know, this temperature over frequency scaling, the power law dependence of the, temperature dependent resistivity. And, a lot of people have been suggesting quantum critical points underlying, somewhere in here, underlying a lot of the physics. And people have been searching around for them. And, so it's conceivable to me that there is, in fact, a strongly interacting quantum critical point describing a transition from a D-wave, zero temperature transition from a D-wave superconductor to a Fermi liquid. And if there is, it would be a confinement type transition. And it would be a pretty interesting quantum critical point. Transitions from superconductor to metals are things which are not understood very well. I mean, except in sort of BCS theory, but that, I can give you another example where this another superconductor to metal transition. Okay, in some sense, this is a superconductor to metal transition. Maybe we can understand this in terms of Fermi liquid theory and BCS, but we're seems to be it's not clear, and it doesn't seem to perhaps be working all that well. But Aaron Kapotulnik's experiments on his molygermanium films with thin superconducting films, where he looks at resistance versus temperature, the TC or whatever it is, 6 Kelvin or something like that. Right. Yeah. No. Okay. Yeah. So he gets things. Well. Okay. What I want to do is put on a magnetic field to put in vortices. Okay. Because I want vortices. That's what he does. I mean, he puts one of his experiments, which is the one that's mysterious. He puts on a magnetic field. He starts getting this a bit of something like this, and then what he finds. Okay. So this is a low field. Much below HC2. Much above HC2, it just looks like this. That is, there's no superconductivity visible. I mean, it's a normal metal film. I mean, that's maybe weakly localized, whatever it is. There's this bizarre region at fields of about a third of HC2 where there's a lot of superconductivity present because the resistance is dropping dramatically near the zero field transition. There's a lot of vortices present because you're at one third of HC2. These are pretty sizable fields. This comes down here and looks like a metal. I mean, in the sense that it's independent of resistance, independent of temperature and the low temperature limit. Okay, and it's like this, and you get this. And so, if you take his data seriously, you've got a metal, and you're tuning a parameter. Okay, here it's the vortex concentration. You clearly have a lot of local superconductivity present. You clearly have a lot of vortices present because you can put the magnetic field on, so you sort of have to think about those. They're both moving around. If you're going to very low temperatures, you need a quantum mechanical description of the vortices, the field-induced vortices and nothing else, and the electrons, presumably, because it's resistive. How do you describe a metal in terms of vortices? This is not a superconductor here. Superconductors don't have a finite resistance, right? This is a weird one. I mean, I know, but so that's okay. So that's like So if you're in a superconductor, if you put on a strong field and the vortices move around, you go into a metal.
Well, that's a state that.
Okay, we sometimes call it a vortex liquid or something.
Yeah, it's sophistry to worry about it not being a superconductor. I mean, of course, it's the vortices that carry the.
Of course, you have to give me a quantum mechanical description of those vortices carrying. I mean, entropy is not relevant here, it's our temperature, which is where we're going.
What the
Well, you know what is interesting to me is if you tune to where this is, looks like it vanishes in the noise, right at the transition, and look at the temperature dependence of the resistance. I mean, it's going to be going towards zero for sure. And I mean, if this is really, this looks like a metal to superconductor transition, and at that transition, it looks like the resistance, I mean, would be vanishing, and presumably, if it's a critical point, it vanishes at the power law in temperature. But you know, it has not been looked at that. It's pretty these are definitely amorphous domes, extremely well calibrated. Worried about heating here, okay? You know, Aaron Kapitulnik has stuck his neck out on this experiment. You know, I mean, and he's been hounded by a lot of theorists saying, you know, heating, and he's raised pretty compelling arguments that that's not the case. You know,
I know some experiments look even more striking, but in the immediate field, they're actually already heating much higher than normal.
But that's striking, but understandable. Yeah. Well, okay, at least in the following sense. I mean, no. In granular superconductors, you get the situation where it comes down like this, and it then becomes insulating. Yeah. You know, so you've got superconducting. At very high field, you kill the superconductivity of the grain, and it's a metal.
Yeah.
But what's weird about this? Okay, but an insulator of Cooper pairs, we understand. Is that? So here, you granular superconductor, you say, okay, Cooper pairs, bosons, okay, they either tunnel and they give you a superconductor, or they don't, and they give you an insulator, a bosonic insulator, right? But this is weird, because this is not an insulator. It's not a superconductor either, it's a metal. Is this a conventional Fermi liquid? God knows. I mean, it's... Okay, but then it's a pretty strange quantum phase, right? What's that? It's not a. Because that at zero temperature, I mean that's sort of this percolation picture, which I at zero temperature. You'd either get a superconductor or a metal. I mean, I think. Okay, and so maybe you want to think about this, okay, as you know, being mostly metallic and having some superconducting inclusions. But it can't really, because look, if those superconducting inclusions are real, honest things, you'd get proximity effect, and it would become. It's. Well, that's strong. Okay, there have to be strongly fluctuating superconducting regions, which aren't really superconducting, right? Okay, and then you're just back to the same thing. Once you sort of coarse grain a bit and look in longer scales, but in these experiments, it's an amorphous film, and there's no reason why one should have any long length scale coming in here. I mean, but I'm not saying I don't understand this. I just don't think this is understood. That's all I'm saying. I mean, but. And I think it's not out of the question that this and this have a connection. I mean, I'm not the first person to suggest this either, but I think it smells pretty interesting. And I don't know. It could just be these are some of the three things we don't understand. And you know, just because we don't understand them all doesn't mean that they're connected. But yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So how does it connect to some other
thing? Well, the model? Yeah, I mean, well, okay, that's an interesting question, and I'd like to think about that. Yeah. We haven't explored that. But we've been focusing on, we've been trying to make contact with everybody else. You know, in some sense, we've been coming from here. But now, I mean, I'd like to go this way a bit, too. Right. Because, I mean, overdoped is perhaps metal. This is weird.
When you move Hubbard, you remove superconducting fluctuation.
Yeah, no, so we have to get a Fermi liquid. I mean, I think, and we, you know, the experiments look like, I mean, the very overdoped, when TC is 3 Kelvin over here, you start seeing sharp species spectral features. No. They can't just be gradually. I mean, you know, at zero temperature as a function of X, it's got to be a zero temperature transition from D wave superconductor, if that's what this is, to a metal, if that's what that is. Right. And, Okay. How do I turn this thing off? Or do we just leave it here continuing to record the buzz of the air conditioner? the lack of air conditioner.
Well, I guess we have
to ask you about the two-particle response. As you approach the one transition in intensity, you get a...
By doping or by varying U? That's different, conceivably. Right. Maybe not. Which one are you doing? Varying U.
A half going. The
leading what?
I can value the pairing matrix goes to 1. Very strange. It doesn't go through 1. It goes to 1 at the transition, at the line.
You're approaching modulation from a metal. You're coming from a metal.
Yeah.
And you're approaching modulation from a metallic side. You're looking at a pairing amplitude? Susceptibility or something?
You're looking at the leading eigenvector of the pairing matrix. So you're actually looking for a continuous transition. So, diagrammatically, you're just looking at...
Yeah, so you're looking at apparent susceptibility.
Well... What you do is you realize I can write this as square root 1 over 1 minus I minus N.
Yeah, then it's an exact thing.
Yeah.
And you look at that thing. Yeah.
Right. You look at the eigenvalues of the pairing matrix.
Yeah.
It's really strange. It's clearly Mott, because it doesn't matter which one. I can look at the zone center, I can look at the zone corner, I can look at the local one. And they all just as a function of U is 1 minus 6.
Okay, so this is metal and this is Mott.
Yep.
So they're largest near the Mott transition.
But they're one. Singular.
That's a one there.
Yeah.
They're
singular, but they go to one. I mean, and they don't, of course, since the order parameter, the conventional Euler for Migdal's order parameter would be, phi over z, and roughly phi is the eigenvector. Roughly the eigenvector is pairing matrix M. Phi, which is a small relocation, is equal to lambda phi.
But does that suggest that if you dope this thing, it would go from a metal to a superconductor?
Nope.
But it doesn't. Okay.
No, it definitely does not, because this eigenvector, lambda, is odd.
Yeah.
And so when pairing.
Yeah. And when I dope it, the odd doesn't win. The Z wave wins. And if I dope it, this is infinite D, I have no, I can prove to you that I have no superconductivity, no D wave superconductivity, it's a trivial proof. So what does it tell you is that there's something special, reminiscent of pairing in the Mott transition. So I don't believe all of this stuff in infinite D about the Mott transition. I think that there's, just like every other transition in infinite D, you look to the appropriate two particle quantities.
And then there's subtleties there already.
This must be related to what? You know what you're saying?
Well, I mean, I think in these spin charge separated, I mean, yeah. These fractionalized Mott insulators have superconducting pairing built into them. I mean, in what sense? Well, in the sense that they have these bisons, which are like the BCS vortices, a piece of the BCS vortex, are there already. They're gapped. Right.
But can you take your theory and try to see if what would happen in the large D limit?
Actually,
I don't know. Is that
and look at the odd frequency pairing response?
Well, no. I mean, you guys are relating the Mott transition to a pair response, right? Really?
In the sense that we're looking at a transition from.
That's what you.
But can you
look at this, okay, it's possible not to give Michael Tucker the other lecture, just try to learn my own. Doug did this, okay, in simulations in 2+1, where you do, you know, acid, a fraction of acid, and leeway pairing panels, you get a superconductor at hospital ring, and you have an antiferromagnet at hospital ring, and there's a difference between those two. Now, can you do the same, for example, have an infinite D have a superconductor at hospital ring and a fermi liquid at hospital ring, or, and look at the difference between those two?
If I do non-local correction, et cetera,
whether it should be in the first just in the dance around it.
Sure.
You wouldn't. I mean, it's very simple.
No, but at off building?
No, it's no.
But could you not? Okay, so.
Apparently,
charge on condensed, both the charge goes on condensed, and And I know they have nowhere near a, you know, commensurate fill length, so they just imagine if you're going to continue. So it's not going to and then at the end of the compulsion. Should this look straight in fire transition when it's being glued on and you go from a boson to a fire transition? You've got these boson world lines and you've got these this weird thermite spins and they're glued on and.
Okay, that description of the state of means. We can go into a deep dark at the
in the English case, we get up intractable, untractable. It's intractable is where it's strong
hoping.
But that's where we want to be.
I mean, maybe it's built equivalent to this is the thought that occurred to me when you were doing this thought. It's like, some of these two sentence the way thought, they to get back to mental.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Sure, it's a
consignment. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a consignment.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah, so just, I mean...
Without convincing the water spaces, you only need to make the water space capitalist or something.
Well, this is, I think you can just use, Okay, and with a very safe term, so we're fixed doping, and we're actually even in the continuum. I mean,
yeah.
One of the CDX wires, we wouldn't be very safe terms. Okay, we can't control it. If you were from there, you were right, might look to something, but let me just think here. So then, K, T, C, yeah, zero. Okay, so K very large,
yeah.
Right? We might as well just put sigma to be a constant,
yeah.
And we have bosons with very small hopping, but it's totally incommensurate. They'll always condense.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's indecimal PC, they'll condense.
They'll condense.
Right.
Yeah.
That's two ways to do
that. Yeah.
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 Now, over here, we have extremely strong confinement.
Yeah.
We have confinement. And the main thing of confinement, okay, of course, is that we're going to have to glue these together. We're going to have to get, we're going to have to glue, we're going to make TS much, much smaller than TC, but TC is much, much smaller than 1, like that. And we can gap the fermions, for that matter.
Yeah, that's US wave.
And then, well, these bosons, okay, they're moving around, they hop weakly, they would be, because they're three bosons, they just keep stacking that. And what has to happen now? We now pass through this transition here.
Yes.
Say world one. Well, we still have to confine it.
Yeah.
So the spins have to get glued back onto the bosons.
Yeah.
And then come back.
Yeah.
And every time we go out, we're pulling. I'm not saying we can describe it, but it's got to be. Why are we being on insulator? It's not from insulating lab. What phase is that?
But it can be a superconductor.
This pattern always can't be a superconductor. Oh, it could be. That's not. Okay. There's no reason. Okay. It could be a DSC star if you put it in, pair operating star or pair star or
so, but it could be just DSC.
We have to go to
the same thing.
It could be, but I don't see why we have to go to the why can't we recover from the liquid? Don't wait over here. Small case, strong confinement. I mean, there's no reason. It's an actual electron. The electron is going to continue. Weakly interactive. What phase? What's the best? Yes, in this phase. Make a break down view.
Yeah, that's good.
Put one goes on here, one over there. And put them so far apart that it won't interact at all.
Yeah. And then, actually, good if we can get a bandage later. Right? Okay. No.
This probably doesn't mean this theory. We just don't.
Yeah, no, if you take a balance later and dope it, we will get a formulation.
Yeah, obviously.
And the balance will be. But you have to dope it. You can't get it by changing.
I know. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but in the Kubrick, it's heavily doused over there,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, okay, so I'm thinking that basically.
So, so even in the sense of this description,
yeah,
you better, I mean, let's say you're doing SPA, and let's say first you're doing no basis, probably. You're not
going
to select on.
To begin with,
yeah, sure. Then you go to PC extremely small, maybe a diamond later.
Yeah.
No return on the doping.
Yeah.
We will get something.
Yeah. So now just do the other way around.
Go to TV or
whatever. No, but don't do that or put it. Start planning doping.
Start planning doping.
This is
everything. Yeah. 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 We will get a
yeah. Dial you both on, we glue the spin back on them, we'll come down these fermions.
Yeah.
By electrons.
Yeah.
So I think the fixed, you know, so I think in the fixed point space, that, you know, there's a quantum critical point here that I'm hoping, and which is, so here's D, which is made, which is, I would like to say, part of this, right? From the liquid. Now, you might say, okay, so where, we know that on a Fermi liquid we do a, you know, BTS instability.
Yeah, we did back to.
But that's what I think. Okay. I think it's way off in the, you know, completely wrong direction.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
so that's why BTS spaces can have.
Yeah,
well,
in other ways, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and for that, okay, but why not have a strong coupling to the metal transition? That's what we've been looking for.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Yeah. Okay, and. And then there's an insulating critical point between this one, and then this goes to, okay, but this goes to some sort of, okay, it's an insulator, either a Y star or, you know, no liquid AF, red star, whatever it is.
That's just
going to
be
all
understanding.
Yeah,
even.
That's good here, because, in fact, okay, so this is what got me thinking about this. I mean, the, at this meeting, it was a lot of, you know, rho S, so the C at rho S zero data by party well, but this huge thing here about the, you know, the linear slope,
yeah,
here, and which, well, in some action, I think it's not that many slopes or anything. All the data collapses here. I mean, all, excuse me, the data collapses from, you know,
from different slopes.
Yeah. This is what you expect for quantum critical lines here,
mm-hmm,
hopefully. And then, but okay, so we don't really understand the quantum critical line that well. We don't even know what phase we're going into, but okay, we want to explore that, it's very interesting. But we're missing, you know, the big picture for this, yeah, the detail there. This huge energy scale, and let's take this relatively linearly seriously, right?
Yeah.
We know that the electron spectral function here is near.
But
not
what
here.
The top of the,
right? So this, yeah, is going to be, I mean, if we want to think of this as spin charge separation, which I do, there's going to be confinement here.
This may still be the critical. Like, if it is symptoms separated here, symptoms confined here. And
I think it could be this. It could actually be. There's a reasoning. I mean, we've been focusing over here, and K has been increasing with X. But it's only for K of X.
Yeah, the effect of K.
Yeah, the effect of K. Now, we. Over here, we said that this has been going up.
Yeah.
Right, and okay, so maybe. Oh, maybe this is part of zero. Okay, so maybe this is the value needed to go a deconfined,
but
right, you know, the one. That could be here, it could be there. Really, it's at least here because it is deconfined. I mean, at least
it's,
right.
It's not by K becoming large.
Well, but the effect is the same. Actually, think about it. I mean, it's
the white one is not, and then it can be super.
Yeah, no, but on the other hand, okay.
The spectral function is still sharp.
Yeah, no, but I mean, okay, if we think, okay,
you're right. But
I mean, I
think
I'm trying to say is, just take
the
experiment
with
the fish.
Yeah. That
experiment
is
totally smearing.
Yeah,
it's basically saying.
Sharp,
yes, well, the metal said,
yeah,
optimal doping
completely.
Yeah, well, actually, probably slightly overkill. Remember, this also falls off on the back of the end. I'm hoping this separates it. Right, okay, maybe this will separate it over here, it'll be sharp here, but actually there's no external evidence for any sharp special function there. The only sharp special function is here, and the weight goes, you know, to 4 to 0, and the CC goes down, and over here.
and you know, coming down here.
Sure.
Okay. So, so this particular point is simple.
This is.
You can go through the
thing. Okay. And, okay, it would be underlined.
Well, it's right here, actually. Here it is.
Separated, and the left effect of motion is going to be here, and this side is sharper.
Yes.
It is. And certainly, what's happening here, it could become confined again, or may not. I mean, I'm perhaps not, you know. Well, we won't worry about it still, but that's a different issue. It's a different issue, right? but, don't we? I mean, you know, we have two transitions. Well, okay.
There are two transitions.
We're talking about this all along, but one of them is referring to liquid.
That's the thing.
I was reading a lot of the plans, so one thought was that maybe it's going to be a little bit close, right?
Like, and optimal doping, perhaps, hopefully, you know, the
he can find.
That's what I'm saying. But there's like, I mean, and a lot of people have also suggested that there is an important critical point somewhere here, and somewhere along this axis, which controls the optimal doping. And then you perhaps be able to assess it if you could somehow suppress the supernatural.
And
the supernatural is irrelevant, but it's just masking the actual quantum critical point that controls the...
Mathematically, that a GCS supernatural, you know, is in this theory, and this is So this is charging boson condensing. Okay. I mean, if we want to think about it, it's not like from electric surface. We want to think about the charging bosons here, you know, and we have to then get back to Fermi liquid. The only zero is a fixed point that we focus on the BCSU is connected, but all about a different way.
Yeah.
And a Fermi liquid. Or about the same way. Yeah. But and the transition between them. All about very differently because it's a confinement transition.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, you know, that's basically this is heading up. These charging bosons are, you know, the density of them is going up, and this is part of the long range cool interactions, right? And this is going up. Why does this continue to keep on going up? Well, eventually.
Eventually.
Well, okay, we all know microscopically that eventually it's going to work in liquid.
Well, yeah, but it goes violently, so it has to be.
You know, Patrick was trying to stop the charging boson from condensing for the gauge of fluctuation. One way to stop charging bosons from condensing is the Lewis fermionic spins in them make electrons. And once they're fermions, they don't condense anymore.
Yeah.
That's what kills it.
Look, that has to be that. It's going to do both to x to 1.
Yeah.
If you have a
exactly.
And then you go for the liquid, so then you.
Yeah, exactly. So an X of R, you're very. Or just very. Yeah, for an X of 1.9.
Exactly. It has to be some low density electron liquid.
We have to get there. So if you want to describe effective theory, we have to come back down again.
So I suppose we can just do it even without explicitly putting in
the case. We can, the reason I like doing that is because you can almost start doing some bullshit argument where you say, look at the Ivy model at the critical point and just try to have I'm sure you can't get the critical properties exactly by doing that, but somehow try to understand the motion of charging bosons moving in the background of critical theory of the Ivy gauge theory. You know, frankly, there isn't that much data over there as well.
mean, I can't really focus on the overdose so much. But I mean, what is overdose in the system like that? I guess I'm just not sure how much. What's dramatic about going to the superconductor, or the last show that it, it, this sharp heat comes up kind of out of the back of that.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas, okay, when you start overdosing, at 20, and you know, this is, okay, down to PC is 20 Kelvin. It's pretty, like, something almost, okay, this isn't this Kelvin, it's something like 9 Kelvin, that's 20 Kelvin. Very overdose.
Yeah.
Okay, it's starting, it is starting to come up, but there's not a sharp heat going out in the background. Right. I mean, and this is actually pretty damn cool, so this is much more than the sharp feature the sharp feature is coming up there. Now, if you're a 4 Kelvin, again, it's not really coming out of the background. It's just starting to build up weight here. At the critical point, this 4 Kelvin, this is basically right at the critical point. You know?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Oh, that's DC or 4 Kelvin, right?
Yeah, that's
right.
Okay, let me just show you. Look at the electron spectral function. Well, this is AFK and omega. So this, at its 100 point, you're expecting to hear how long.
Yeah.
Right, so that's not a sharp feature coming out of the background, it's a power law.
I mean, this thing is sharp, but then the game.
I would like to pretend, okay, this looks different, certainly. Yeah,
you know,
this is a case, but I can leave it at that.
Well,
no, it smells alright. I think we're running from. Compare this in the superconductor to this.
Well, then there's a tail.
Well, no, I'm just saying, okay, this. In fact, this is tails, which is this huge incoherent background.
Yeah,
right. But
this bit was this, this ball back.
It's exactly, and it comes down. I mean, you just. Okay, I mean, it doesn't come here and go back up, certainly like that. Right? And actually, you know, okay, this is, you can write this through a power law. And,
right, so I might have tried to put this through the power law, save this, I mean, totally.
There's no reason. But another thing that's a crucial feature, because this thing is growing as you approach the critical point, so 20 Kelvin, 4 Kelvin, in a normal state, this thing is, these are critical fluctuations being rounded off the critical point, and then whereas this is, as you go super conducting, it's just, this is the width, it just comes out. Right?
Yeah.
So this is building up very differently. Much more,
if you
expect if you're approaching a critical point with a power wall there. This would have been a power wall as well, just your way from the critical point, I guess.
Very so low energy is sort of near all.
Yes, very low.
So what would this sort of data, is there, you're sitting over here.
No, but this is the data.
If you're over here, there's this extremely broad because of the data, and go in,
it starts sharpening up. And this is what Ornstein and the people analyze. And they say it all correlates with a phase coherent temperature that they talk about. Which is maybe 10 degrees above there. Which is where it looks like there's critical fluctuations. And they say it's phase fluctuations. And they say that's where this thing starts blowing up. When you start phase ordering, why should that start getting the best?
At optimal doping, the normal phase is supposed to be this broad
So
above TC is the dash. It's not much of a. There's no fully possible feature. So below TC, there's a sharp there. Now, let's say you go overdose.
Overdose, this is in the normal state. These are all the normal states.
These are all the normal states. They can only get.
If I have a 4 Kelvin. It's 2201, it's 2202, like that.
Yeah, okay.
But now you're down to 4 Kelvin, which is a clear friendly overdose. You are getting what looks like a
peak, but actually it doesn't look like this. It looks like just a, you know, smoothly diverging thing.
But so anyway, would you say that this peak is hissing? I mean,
no,
the
peak
there is a dash line here.
Yeah, well, I would say that...
So this is normal.
No, I mean, this is the normal state of the optimally dome is this. So let's do optimally dome. That, this is the same as that, the dash line.
Right, so this and this, you would say...
I would say these are critical fluctuations building up.
Okay.
Right, as you go from optimally dope, overdope, 20,000, oh, this is actually okay, overdope, 22,000, it's not much overdope.
Yeah. So it's more than optimally dope.
It's more than optimally dope, overdope, and it's starting to build up critical points, basically, 4,000. Okay, the peak, but basically, it's not like this, right, where it's,
the peak, you know, is actually here.
It looks basically the same as the normal state here, except it's building up many, you know, perhaps an algebraic similarity. I'm going to be able to tell that it's not function of algebraic in this data, but...
Yeah.
But if I put the electron special function in a Fermi liquid, and I think you basically just put the delta function and then think of your background. I mean, maybe you think of your background as this, but there's no obvious reason this should build up like this.
Yeah.
I mean, if we tell them to smear thermally or something, you know, but and actually, but in a Luddington liquid,
it's
a power wall, right?
Yeah.
But in, of course, in our in these fifth-order separated things, it's actually very close to zero. Right,
there is no.
Yeah, so you know, it's weird. If you work out sigma two of omega, the magnitude part of the energy. Which, you know, and optimally dope goes as omega or T, marginal from liquid or whatever, you know. And, okay, the Fermi liquid.
Yeah, that's just omega over T.
It is, yeah. Okay, so, this is a critical point,
yeah.
Right? So, but, okay, N equals 2 in a Fermi liquid, N equals 1 in, at a critical point, really.
Yeah.
Right? In a Luddington liquid, which in some sense is a critical point,
omega is some other.
Actually, it's probably, yeah, it's probably omega is some other power, yeah. Right? Smaller than 1. But in a, in spin chart separated, you know, I star.
Yeah.
No, let me, in fact, do it at this one. We have a little special point here, this critical point.
Yeah.
Where it's zero energy, right? And then it looks like your end is like minus 1.
What?
I mean, this is just changing. If you assume A of K and omega is, then, you know, something like linear in omega, and you just work out, you know, that A is sigma 2 over, you know, omega minus sigma 1 squared plus sigma 2 squared.
Yeah.
So if you sit right at EF, and,
sigma 2
over 1 over sigma 2, I don't know. But it's just, okay. But Powell is, you know, I mean, the fact that people are saying an optimal dose, well, I don't know, this is probably the kind of theory. It's not a big deal, really. I mean, it's very, very different than allowing the liquid, I mean, I guess.
That this principle
point. No, after the spin charge separated phase.
Oh, all okay. Day.
It's smeared much, much more than a lot of the liquid. A lot of the liquid is like it, at a critical point. A lot of the liquid is almost a Fermi liquid. This critical point is, okay, it may be almost a Fermi liquid.
Right.
So this is a critical point. But it's going to be, something, you know,
any more than a liquid, perhaps. So this region has, defined, this is really good, it goes to the linear region. Start becoming more of a machine after.
Yeah, I think they do. You know, so you would expect to be.
Yep.
The thing is, if we don't know how the energy scales with x, and you know, it, frankly, it could even be, you know, it could be. Okay, I don't know how you want to draw this, but we don't know. They don't have to finish slope the cost of the linear side.
Sure.
Right. So, and if we want to think, if we want this one of the ones to be, you know, up to 1,000 tub, it has to be driving pretty sharply.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're coming down here and you're making it this.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
And we start looking like
Amino here. Sure. As put Amino here, it's a different.
Yeah, okay.
It's a different one.
It's true.
but you know, we just don't. This is a. Well, let me put it another way. There is a there's a quantum point here.
Yeah.
There's a quantum wave position there. The there's dirt back going out.
I think up here.
Yeah. We can totally ignore dirt. I mean, we might need room classes to break it. Otherwise, we would assume it's zero away.
But okay, let's just hopefully it was just
there. I mean, that's something with photo emission. Okay, it's an optimal doping. But, and down here, it's, you know, it's sharp. If you start going way up here, for the thousands of Kelvin, I mean, big energy scale, this is why it's quantum critical. And it looks, you know, they pull out, you know, sigma 2 from the But they look at the width of the very broad feature, basically. Right, if they look at the width above CC, above CC, you look at the width and the
very broad.
It's quite hard to define a width, and then you'll argue when they argue about how they fit it a little bit and so forth. They have to move away from the Fermi energy, right?
Yeah.
And look at how the width varies.
Yeah.
And they try to do that, and they get looks like linear and anger. So it's not pretty, those are pretty energy. I think they're pretty much. I can't remember exactly. They can't be too tiny because their resolution is much better than 100 Kelvin.
Right? I just feel that I'm sort of really good for.
The fact that I can see dispersing off and looking at it, it's got to be thousands of Kelvin. Right? And so that's the.
Wow, you guys are still at this? I just came back from this faculty meeting,
Courtney
Lennon. Matthew Fisher. Matthew Fisher here.
Matthew Fisher's not here. Is she the only one having the exam, or the others?
Well, the others, but your name was definitely called out. And we don't talk about it.
Can you explain why?
There was also Pochinski, too. Pochinski was there.
I mean, I knew this would come up.
That's like a monster.
Well, I mean, the critical point that she's trying to look at
is other energies.
How do we know?
You mean that theory?
How can it tell? The curl of A, we're going to do representation whether or not we're commensurate about an underlying lattice.
Yeah. So this one, if all she's studying is confinement and stuff, then the two things we watch here is converted to the other side.
No, it's just that. Yeah, no, it's just spread on the vortex mass going down to zero.
Yeah.
Which it has to do either.
Exactly.
But, and the curl of A, you know, with curl of little a, you know, that is actually being ignored completely at this stage.
Yeah.
I think we want to try to think about scaling and imagining. The critical property is going to depend on what phase you're going into. I think they will, because that's why I started misguidedly thinking about this guy. Okay, so this is the S wave. This guy is the guy going. You know, it's sort of like this guy. It's not so much. It was one where I somehow, when I was first thinking about it, thought maybe this. I just started thinking about this as a common critical point, and kind of interesting one, I guess. And sort of, where this is Ising, and this is.
So this one can imagine studying the phase in the material.
Scott and Mara, I think, that's true. And, but the point is here presumably, conventional dynamical common scaling works, and I'll give you the constant here and here.
Yeah.
And,
it's
not, okay, it's probably a constant as well, but I mean, but it's probably still goes on here, so yeah. The scaling is still probably work. I'm assuming that there's a metal transition.
I think it's very reasonable that the continuous transition, which I think it should be, or could be, that the resistance comes down.
Fermions of temperatures, you know, getting up some fraction of the fermi energy, or